May. Lowell, Highway 401, Ontario.
We had burrowed into the snow next to Sertan's frozen corpse, and were relying on the shelter provided to protect us from the wind and snow. As Zyla huddled next to me for warmth, both of us were silent. I spent the next eternity reliving my life over and over again inside my mind. The birth of Zyla and Cabo, the death of my mother, the attack of the Desperate Ones, memory after memory, until everything began to fall away from me. Every moment of joy, every instance of despair, every tragedy, my family, my hopes and dreams, exploding with vibrant colors in my mind before fading to void. I knew we would die here, Zyla and I, the last of us. And as Zyla's shivering stopped, I could not help but feel a deep pride and love for our pack. Despite the tragedy of our song, we'd always tried. My final moments were filled, not with despair, but with love.
Sylvia, 41, Highway 401, Ontario.
It's probably been a week by now. Said he'd be right back. I didn't know what he was up to. I woke up feeling kind of drug out that morning, you know? Body didn't want to move that much. I was too tired for whatever reason to bother to question him about it. I was too tired to worry about him. I was just groggy, I guess. But after an hour passed, I was up and about and that knot started tying itself in my stomach again. I tried not to think about it too much. I tried to absorb myself with organizing our gear, then cleaning the garage, weeding the garden just outside the door here. I remember pulling up a few weeds and squeezing them hard in my fist. I remember the scent of the earth, how it was cold and squishy. I remember holding my breath at certain points and sitting back and just trying to listen to the forest. For anything. For any little sound. I needed to hear him coming home, trudging through the brush. Him maybe chopping a tree down somewhere with his axe in the distance. He did take his axe with him, so at first I thought that might have been what he was up to. Chopping a tree down for us for some reason. By about noon, the knot in my stomach was pulling itself so tight I could hardly stand. It was making me wheeze, and the whole cottage seemed like it was spinning. I know I fainted at some point. Time gets kind of funny when you're alone. I remember opening my eyes and I was lying on the floor, staring up at the ceiling of the cottage. The color of the rays of light coming through the window was pink, and I knew it was getting close to dusk. Something made me get up. Somehow I managed to pull myself to my feet, went outside and I started a fire in our little makeshift fire pit. Dad had decided we wouldn't have any more fires outside at night. We didn't know what was out there after all, and Dad didn't want us dragging any more attention to ourselves than we absolutely had to. But that night I couldn't stop myself. I don't know if part of me thought he might be lost or what. If me starting a fire, if he saw the fire, that might be the beacon he needed to find his way back to me. Even if it made him angry, I didn't care. I didn't care if he came back pissed off. I just wanted him to come back. So, I let the fire grow and grow. Started with a teepee of kindling first, and eventually built a little cottage around it using some of the bigger cut pieces that we had stockpiled a few weeks earlier. And the fire kept getting bigger and bigger, and I kept staring at it, putting more wood on it. But the whole time, listening. I don't know how far it was into the night, but at some certain point, I just had this chill wash over me. My whole body. Bumps popping on the back of my neck, and I knew. I just knew. For certain, something had happened. He was gone. He wasn't coming back. And so I stopped listening to the woods. And all I could do was stare at the fire. I remember camping with my dad years earlier, when I was a kid, with him and Mom and my brother Stephen. Whenever the fire got to that point, where we were letting it burn out, my dad, he'd always look at the embers of our campfire and he'd point them out to me. He'd say, "Look at those. You know what those are? Those are the lights in the city at night." And then we'd watch them. Watch them as they slowly disappeared into darkness. One by one. Lights fading out. And then the fire was gone. When Mom left us, she took Stephen with her because he was still young. And Dad, his drinking got worse. He was using it as a crutch for things he was missing and, well, I mean, he got fired for swigging from that Mickey when he was on shift. When we went camping after that, I was a teenager by that point, we'd stare at the fire, watch the fire turn to embers, and watch the embers wink out, one by one. "There goes the city," he'd say. Almost like the city was leaving him. Like it was leaving him to be alone by himself. Our last fire together, 2 weeks ago, we were staring at the fire together, watching the flame turn to embers, and the embers started fading. And I knew what he was thinking. I knew what he was going to say. Except he never said it. We just kept staring at the pit until it turned black. When you came walking out of the trees this afternoon, I knew you weren't him. I knew you weren't Dad. Dad is gone. Has been for a week. But I wanted you to be him. I wanted you to be... I'm sorry. I don't have any food for you outside of a carrot or two. And I'm going to need you to leave here in the morning. But I'm not going to leave. I know he's gone, but I'm not leaving till he comes back.
Esau, 45, Highway 401, Ontario.
Forget the interview. Because we got deals for you, brother. We got deals for you. You can pick things up here. Things that have meaning. Things that resonate, brother. In your soul, brother. That's what I mean when I say we got deals, brother. This wheelbarrow isn't just a wheelbarrow. This wheelbarrow is a cradle for lives that have been lived. I have for you this wallet. Taken from a very big man. Big like Goliath. Tall. More than 7 feet tall. In Kingston, I met him. And when they take him, they leave this behind. His wallet. You can see all of the details of his life from this. His driver's license. He was 55 years old. You can tell the details of his life from this. This is not just a wallet. This is a story. And stories keep you warm, brother. They keep you warm when you are alone. And then I have this. This is a hatchet, brother. Very sharp, good condition. But it is more important that this hatchet was the property of a young man, brother. This young man, he was my friend. He was very close to me. We traveled together for weeks. But when they took him, they left this hatchet. And now here it is. Do you want it? It is a good hatchet. Used to build many lean-tos, to split much firewood. See the sheath? He carried it on his belt, always. This young man, my temporary friend. Here is a dress. I never met the woman who wore it. I found it hanging in the closet of a house I stayed in one night. The house had no people in it. They must have been taken a long time before. And I found this dress in the upstairs closet. Here. Feel this dress. Touch the dress with your fingers. Feel the materials on your fingers. Now, imagine the dress on a woman. She was very beautiful, this woman. She was in some pictures I found in the house. Her hair was blonde. She had a husband and 2 children. I think they were her children. I never met them. I never met her family. But I saw them in the pictures I found. I stayed in this woman's house for a night last month, during a bad storm. This woman was very nice to me. I never met this woman. But I would have died if I had been outside in the storm. This woman was very nice to me. I never met this woman. But she let me stay in her house. Feel the material with your fingers. It is very soft. I think she must have been very kind. There are many things I have here in my wheelbarrow. I carry them with me because I am not sure why. Sometimes I do not know why I pick them up. Sometimes I know they hold stories, but I do not know what stories they hold. This is a plastic bird, a flamingo. It is pink. I took it from someone's front yard. I do not know why I took it. I was walking through a town a few weeks ago. I saw this plastic bird. I could not stop looking at it. No one was around. The street was quiet. I was alone. And I could not stop looking at this bird. It was all alone. The only decoration in someone's front yard. Like, it was all alone. Like, it was standing guard. I do not know why, but I took it. They are called flamingos. They are made out of plastic. Turn off the recorder. Turn off the recorder. You do not have to record this. There is nothing to record. There is no one here. Just me. And even me, I am not here. I am not here. Just this wheelbarrow is here. The big man is not here. Just his wallet. The lady is not here. Just her dress is here. I am not here. I do not think I am here anymore. Just this wheelbarrow is here. That is all that is left of me. It is all that will be left when they come and take me. Do you want it now? Do you want anything here? When you think of them, these things, like stories, then you want them. That is how I used to feel. And so I would pick things up and put them in my wheelbarrow. And I came to love these things I would find. Because I would think of them like stories. But recently, I have stopped thinking of them as stories. Recently, I have started to think of these things like they are people. They are all that is left. That is why I say that I am not here right now, talking to you. All that is here is a wheelbarrow. Because that is all that is left of me. And it is filled with things that are all that is left of people. And I have been collecting these things for more than 2 months, brother. I think I must have been crazy when I started doing this. I am worried that part of me has gone crazy. But whether I am crazy or not, I know this to be true. I am not here. So don't bother recording me. I am just this wheelbarrow. That is what is happening to me.
Callie, 37, Shannonville, Ontario.
What I've ended up missing the most through all of this, besides television, and with the loss of television, I mean, we all took a big hit on that one. I still don't fucking know who won the last season of Survivor, which I'm still kind of fucking pissed off about, but I probably shouldn't get myself going about that one. How stupid people are is the thing that I miss the most. Without people around so much anymore, that's what I miss. Without civilization happening around us, I miss how stupid people can be. People mowing their lawns wearing nothing but flip-flops. I miss watching people do stuff like that. Families with small children keeping giant dogs as pets. People forgetting to leave the emergency brakes on in their vehicles and watching their car roll backward down the hill in the city. I miss watching people chugging beer out of funnels and getting into fights with each other because they're too drunk to understand what the other is saying. I miss people texting while they drive. I miss people locking their keys inside of their cars, then having to try and break back in through their driver's side windows with a coat hanger. I miss seeing people driving Hummers. I miss seeing lazy newspaper delivery guys just throwing the paper at the house, not aiming, not even trying to get the thing on the step, just chucking the thing in the building's general direction. I miss hearing people telling racist jokes and sexist jokes and complaining about how minorities or women are getting paid too much or are stealing jobs away from young white men. I miss hearing people getting all pissed off about turbans. I miss hearing about politics. Every stupid political thing ever. Senators spending the government's money to cover their own personal vacations. Members of Parliament getting caught for tweeting things they shouldn't or saying things they shouldn't. I miss hearing about celebrities getting caught cheating on their wives with their maids or nannies or gardeners or tennis instructors or whoever. I miss hearing about people making mistakes on live television, not being able to pronounce some game show contestant's name or whatever. I miss hearing about how stupid people are. That's what I miss the most. I don't want to be the last person on Earth, ever. Because that'll mean I'm the stupidest person on Earth, and I don't want that. I want there to be people left so I can make fun of them. Because when you make fun of people, you don't have to think about yourself so much. Everything that's wrong with you. Everything you've done wrong in your life. The less people around you, the more you focus on yourself. The hell of yourself.
Bird, 32, Tiendanaga, Ontario.
They came through here a couple of days ago. Those military fellas from Toronto. So if you're thinking about going that way, you might as well forget about it. Because things aren't going so good in Toronto anymore. According to those guys from the military. I guess they were all going AWOL or whatever. Heading east. But you came from the east. You must have just missed them. It's always funny, I think to myself, whenever I run into people who are stuck in that kind of thinking. They can just go AWOL or whatever. The people who think they can just take off, and when we're all connected, every one of us, to Mother Earth. We're all, like the Creator tries to show us we're connected. Just think, the crow or the geese, everything that flies away into the sky, but eventually it's all gotta land again. Come back to Earth, all the birds, all my people, because we're connected. The world's not ending this way. We know better than that. You just miss them, you know. Everyone I know. Over there, you see that? That's a longhouse. The longhouse is a place where we go and meet. It's a symbol, because Tiendanaga was always known as a meeting place. Always. But then the government burnt down all the longhouses back in the day. And the government brought out the Indian agents and tried to control the people and send the children to residential schools. They thought that they could trick us or make us forget our connection to this place. But resiliency is our strength. The Haudenosaunee people, we held on to our culture, our language. We held on to so much. We are tough, tough people. We had to be. And we understand, you know. We understand that we are connected. You see over there? Right now, leaning against that wall at the longhouse, you know what those are? Lacrosse sticks. Real lacrosse sticks. Hickory. You ever play lacrosse? Except we don't call it lacrosse here. It's the Creator's game. It's medicine. A gift from Creator. When we play, it makes us stronger. And we each make each other stronger by playing it. Because everyone brings their own gifts to the game. We were just playing it. Here, 2 weeks ago, right over there, there were 8 of us left then. Brothers and sisters. And then some, them went spearfishing because it's that time of year. The water is still cold as ice and the fish are spawning. They went at night, cause that's when we do it. That's when we gotta go. But the ones who went fishing didn't come back. The rest of us went looking. We split up in the daylight. Didn't make no difference. When we got back to the longhouse, there was even less of us than before when we went looking. We got back, there was just the three of us left. Then the night, Janice Goodleaf, she went missing. And the day after that, Tom was gone too. I didn't find him anymore. And he was a real good player. Tom was of the game. So if Toronto's out, and you say the States are out, Montreal's out, I guess you're gonna have to head north, eh? I got a couple motorcycles. I fix them up as a hobby. You could hop on my spare. It's a Kawasaki. I'll give you a pretty sweet ride, my little Kawasaki. I'll ride with you for a bit, show you the way, but then I'll be coming back here. Maybe they'll be back by then, my people. Because this isn't how the world ends. We know better than that. We're connected. Skål then.
Yana, 46, Belleville, Ontario.
When we were younger, Anna and I, in Victoria, our families had immigrated there together. My mother and Anna's mother were very good friends, so they were very happy when we became good friends too. Anna and Yana, we were always spending time together, always having fun together, running around Victoria like two little squirrels. We joined the band together in school. After we quit the rowing team together, we were on the track and field team together. We would pass books between each other. I would finish reading a novel and then give it to her, and she would exchange that with me for one she had just finished. This is why I gave her my book when she met me at the train station in Toronto this past Christmas. I never think of things in order, see what I mean? But in Victoria, as children and running, track and field, she was always faster than me. I would always be trying to catch her. I could never catch her. We did the 400 meters. I only ever saw her back. Shoulders, calves, earlobes. I'm still cold. And calm, too. When we were younger, Anna was always calm, calculating, precise. I was the emotional one, the fool, the impulsive. I remember once we had to go on this field trip. Our science class in high school, they loaded us all up together on the school buses and drove us north and out of the city to Goldstream Provincial Park to watch the salmon run. Thousands and thousands of salmon are born there every year, and then they swim out into the ocean until they mature. Then they stop eating and swim back out of the ocean and up the river that they were born so that they can find another salmon to mate with. And then they just die. Their bodies, exhausted, falling apart on them as they try and muscle their way through it all. Upstream, all extinct, skin peeling, scales flaking, tails splitting, color fading, falling apart, but never stopping. I didn't like it. The whole thought of it all, that these fish would reach a point in their life where they were all extinct and dying and mass struggling against a never-ending current. This mass of a population fighting against current and all the while unstoppably eroding. I remember Anna just looking at the river, which was so full of dying fish you couldn't see the bottom of the stream. "But that's life," she said to me. "That's why it's beautiful." I was so careless growing up. I was the one who left first. Left Anna alone on her family's doorstep, and I hopped in Vasily's station wagon heading east to Winnipeg. I was the one who tried not to think about such things as... Then you realize you have swam too far away from each other, and there is this desperate push to get back. That's why I took the train from Winnipeg to Toronto this past December, leaving Vasily to his own depression and devices. Anna had moved to Toronto to be with her new husband, Jules. That's why I spent Christmas there. Why we were together when the event started. And then, there is no order anymore. As we ran into the core of downtown Toronto that night in January, she was sprinting ahead of me. I could not catch her. And so many people were screaming around us, and I did not know where we were. I only knew that we were somewhere trying to get the Jules. That Jules was downtown, and that Anna was not calm anymore. She was not calculating. She was running. Sprinting, falling apart, muscling through people and leaping barricades to get to Jules. I remember passing a hot dog vendor with a sign on his cart that said, "End of the World Blowout." He was passing polka music on his little stereo, and people were hanging around him, dancing and eating. I remember running through a group of policemen. Anna knocked one over as she sprinted through. He screamed at us. I don't know what. My heart was hurting my lungs. I could barely breathe. I was so scared of losing her and all of it. We ran past the university and turned onto Yonge, and that is where we saw all of the tanks, military tanks, lined up and driving up the street. And people were screaming around us, and I could hear the whoosh in the distance, quiet but loud. And I turned my head just enough to see the purple lights behind us closing in. That's when the tanks started firing, and Anna ran into the lobby of an old building, and I tried to follow her into the building, but the building, it just exploded, and she was... I saw her run into it, and it... And then my body was flying, thrown backward. That's the last thing I remember about it, any of it. Toronto. Anna. My best friend. When I woke up, it was maybe a day later. Very bright light. Sun in my eyes. And I was in a stretcher being carried by these military men. They had established a temporary base on the outskirts of the city. I spent the rest of January living inside the husks of several gold trains with any other civilians that they could round up. And then they started disappearing too. The military men. And when they were too few of them left to try and keep us there any longer, me and a handful of others packed whatever we could scavenge together, and we began to head east, because we thought maybe it might be better out east. Maybe we could make it to the sea. Maybe we could find a boat, leave the mainland. Maybe we would be safe in Newfoundland or the Magdalen Islands. Some place where we could all stop disappearing, eroding, flaking, We traveled along the main highway for a while. In March, I think. Until we lost someone. And then we lost someone else. After that, we stuck to the smaller roads. But it didn't matter. By the time we reached the edge of this place, this town, Belleville, there were only three of us left. Myself, this young girl, who was originally from Iqaluit, and this shaggy man from Yellowknife. Almost a week ago now, in this town, it was just after breakfast. We were huddled together looking at our map, and then we heard the whooshing sounds again, nearby, too close, so we all ran, scattered, into this place. And I tried to turn my head as I was running to see if they were still with me, but they weren't. So I tried to climb that construction scaffolding to see if I could see them from higher up, and then my hand slipped, and I fell. And when I fell, when I landed, I heard the snap, and I thought that was it for me. I thought that was the end. But then you and your friend showed up, and you brought me here. This restaurant. And then you brought out your tape recorder, and I thought that that was something different. That we might be something different. But now, even your friend is gone. But you found the antibiotics, and so that might be something. But I'm still cold. Yes, you're still here. I'm still here. But I can't help think about Anna. How she kept looking at the salmon when we were young. I didn't like the thought of it. But that's life. That's why it's beautiful.
Ollie, 64, Bancroft, Ontario.
He gave that mug to me as a gift. I can't remember when. Whether or not it was a Christmas present or a birthday present, but the whales on the side of it, they disappear when you fill it with hot water. Just wait until I get this water to boil and pour you your tea. The whales will disappear from the side of it. Or they come back after you drink your tea, though. I am very lucky to have a wood stove. Justin decided that the cottage would be heated naturally. No oil furnace, that kind of thing. He'd be the one up at 5 in the morning starting the fire. We have the furnace down in the root cellar, down below us. The vents carry the heat all throughout the house. Keeps the house very warm. I'm never cold. We were never cold. I do all of my cooking now on the thing. I basically just boil vegetables from the cellar or cans of whatever I can. I've started going into the stores, restaurants around here, when I can, taking what I can for food to stock up. I cook everything right on the surface of the wood stove. I have always been a terrible cook. You've been warned. I can make all my tea, but if you're staying for supper, oh, and I hope you do stay for supper, oh, it'd be lovely to have someone to talk to. Don't expect any miracles. All I can do is boil things, or heat them up and drown them in margarine and salt and maybe soy sauce if I got any of that left, but I think I used the last I had last night. Justin was the one who did all of the cooking here. I did all of the easy stuff, the no-brainer stuff. I do the dishes and make tea and clean. I did a lot of the easy indoor stuff. He did the cooking and the outdoor stuff, like getting wood. We both kept the garden together, though. We'd take care of the garden together. We'd help each other with the garden. things are quiet enough around the lake here. We kind of always just did what we felt like. Life was so slow-paced around here to begin with, is what I mean by that. So, if Justin or I ever got on each other's nerves, one of us would go for a walk, or swim in the lake, or go fishing, or read a book. Well, I did most of the reading. Justin liked building furniture out in the garage. He had a pretty full setup out there. All his equipment, you know, that he needed. He built this cottage himself, you know, before I ever met him. We met each other online. Oh, I miss the internet. The internet was so much fun. We met through a dating site, and he drove all the way into Toronto to meet me. I was a university professor at the time, history, bored to tears with my job. We went out to this very nice restaurant downtown, and I could tell he was nervous. But I was nervous too, so that was okay. And he couldn't stop talking about this place, his cottage, because he knew everything about it, because he built it by hand, himself. I could tell he was really lonely, because, well, sometimes men will start these really big projects, you know? I mean, look at the detailing on that banister. The amount of work he must have put into it. The cabinets in the kitchen, he made those. Not a crooked line, an off angle anywhere. Everything in this house is perfectly level. And he told me all about it. When he drove me out here for the first time, I knew everything about the place already. He told me everything, how the wind sounds as it blows across the lake and make the trees creak, how the patio winds around the north corner of the house and around to the west so you can watch the sunsets over the water. That one spot in the parlor on the floor he screwed up on that squeaks every time you step on it. The pine walls and floors. I knew the place already. Felt like stepping into a good book. So I stepped into it. And I became a character. And we began our story. We wrote many chapters. But in November, Justin had to step out of the book we were writing. At first, I kind of panicked. I didn't know what to do. I locked all the doors. I did an inventory of all my stuff and everything in the root cellar. The only thing close to a weapon we had in the place was the poker for the fireplace. I remember. I grabbed a hammer and some nails from Justin's tool shed, and I started boarding up all of the windows inside the house, and then the doors. And I was boarding up the last door, the front door, the one that's behind you there. And I was holding a piece of board across the door frame with one hand, and holding the board and holding the nail in the board so that I could hammer it in, because I had the hammer in my other hand, and I dropped the nail. It slipped out of my fingers. So I bent over to pick up this nail that I had dropped, and I threw out my back. I threw out my back trying to nail my own front door shut. I could barely move for days. So when my back got better, I decided to take all of the boards down again. I felt embarrassed for thinking that they might have done any good at all. I stopped locking the doors after that night, too. Because whatever it was had already gotten Justin. And if they or it or whatever wanted to take me, then all of my boards wouldn't be much of an obstacle. The snow fell outside. I rarely had to leave. I went snowshoeing around the lake a few times in February. I read a lot. There were points where I missed Justin very much. I left the doors unlocked the rest of the winter. I've been surviving off of the squash and carrots and potatoes in the root cellar we took from last year's garden. There's still food left down there. I couldn't eat it all myself. In fact, now that I think of it, let me prepare you a bagful. Oh, there's plenty extra you can take with you. I don't mind sharing, not at all. You're going to be passing through Maynooth if you keep going north. Oh, if you meet the gentleman who runs the general store up there, oh, make sure to say hello, if he's still around. Tell him Ollie Caverhill has opened up his cottage to the public, and he's more than welcome to stop by for a meal of boiled vegetables and a cup of tea. Oh, tell everyone you meet for that matter. Oh, you seem like a good judge of character. Well-traveled.
Fortune of Wolves was written by Ryan Griffith. The series was produced by Big Noise Audio Collective and presented by Theatre New Brunswick. The show was directed by Ryan Griffith with help from Gillian Hansen. Recording, editing, and sound design by Matt Carter. Music for the series was created by Counting On Downstairs with additional scoring by Matt Carter. To learn more about the series and the artists involved, visit tnb.nb.ca or look for the Big Noise Audio Collective on Facebook. This episode featured Kat Hall as the Chief Archivist, Jason McIntyre as Lowell, Charisse Lebrun as Sylvia, Marc-André Chiron as Isu, Rebecca Tremblay as Callie, David Miracle as Bird, Scott Harris as Ollie, and Tanya Breen as Yana. Next time on Fortune of Wolves.
Where's your mom and dad, Julia?
Gone.
They're gone. Okay, where'd they go?
The bird people.
Those things that have been taking everyone? Don't worry, they've been all through this place up here too.
How could you turn your back on noise like that?
They might get most of us, but they won't get all of us.
Hide, stupid!